Anyone that wants to open the Tovana site and get a beautiful recording of Arabic wedding music, that's what will happen. So the title of the talk is Ahamkara. And Ahamkara is a Pali word meaning the tendency for making a self, the I-making. A wave if you can't hear me because there's competition there. I'll do my best, or maybe you can also come closer if you like, because against the competition, I might not be able to beat it. Place is right here next to me. Yeah, it's not easy. I'm talking about an impossible subject to talk about, and it's in English, and it's competing with a wedding. So if something gets through, wonderful. And if it doesn't get through, doesn't matter. Forget it. Yeah, and me too. Yeah, the issue of selfing, of the self, is one of these things that we can't talk about it and we can't not talk about it. So it's a problem. If any of you with all the problems that we have in this talk tonight, but if any of you feel that anyway the subject of selfing is simply too much and you want a simple-minded approach to your practice and you just want to sit down, shut up and see what's going on in this body-mind and you don't want to know Buddhist concepts about self, you have an absolute permission to forget everything that I'm going to be saying tonight, okay? It's fine. Anyway, you'll forget it. How many hundreds of Dharma talks you listen to and how many do you remember? So anyway, it's going, so don't worry about it. But actually talking about the self does create some uncomfortable feelings because it's in a way the only thing we know. We know who we are. And we feel we can kind of rest in that place. Well, at least I know where I am. I'm not perfect, I suffer and so on, but at least I know me. And I don't want to hear about something not reliable about the me that I know. It's the only one I've got. I don't have anything else. So don't tell me that I don't exist. So the self, the me that I know, seems so solid and so unquestioning and so real and so obvious. Everything happens to me. And the classic thing is, okay, talk to me, talk to someone else about non-self, but whose knee is it that's really hurting right now? It seems totally obvious, and that's why it's difficult to talk about also. But it is so central to the Buddhist teaching that we can't not listen to it, not think about it. We can't avoid it. And it's not only the Buddhist teaching. There will not be any authentic spiritual teaching that would say you need more of the self. You need to be more selfing. I have a quote from the Kabbalah, from a medieval mystical teacher of Palestine in the 13th century that said the only thing you need to keep touching is this sense of being and nothingness. Being and nothingness. The whole Kabbalah is based on that. So it kind of, we can't avoid it. We can't avoid talking about it, thinking about it, and to some extent building a view of reality in which we take into account that there are things that we don't know because we're locked in me. Because a limited horizon. And it's not just theoretical, but most of the pain that we experience and pain and suffering that we experience in life comes directly from there. So it's actually not theoretical at all. When we lose something that hurts us, or we lose someone close to us, the body doesn't know it. The cells don't know it. The me knows it. And the me holds that pain, maybe for the whole life. And the me carries that pain. Every time we are shouted at, every time we have conflict with somebody, every time we feel someone puts us down or lifts us up, every time we are jealous or angry with somebody or protective or defensive, or we fight wars against our neighbors and we kill each other. It's not bodies that do that. It's selves that do that. So there is a big story about the suffering that the self creates. Not the bodies, but the selves that sit inside the bodies. You know the Buddhist story of the second arrow. That suffering is not when someone, an arrow hits you, strikes you, causes pain, it's just pain. But the arrow strikes you, and what we tend to do after that is take the arrow and hurt us again and again and again. Be busy with it. I'm the victim. It's happened to me. Who's the enemy? What I have to do with it? Etc. Talk, going round and round is the second arrow that we hit ourselves with it. And the second arrow is the me that is busy with maintaining suffering. I remember one time, true story, I drove to the University of Haifa. I was, I hate to tell you, this is the me that now is the... I went to Ulpan to learn Hebrew. In the University of Haifa. Total failure. But you see, if I was full of a me about that, I would have learned Hebrew a long time ago. I actually, the me doesn't care. So I learned, I went every day to the University of Haifa to learn Hebrew and failed. And the me didn't care. Anyway, one day I went there and I parked my old Subaru in the parking lot, and when I came out, it was gone. But the fact was, I parked it next to a Subaru that was exactly the same as mine. The same model, the same Subaru station, the same color, more or less the same year. Two next to each other. Mine was stolen. I thought, my first thought was, why didn't you take the other one? If he so much wants a Subaru station. And then I thought, it's crazy, it's a theory of the me. I own that Subaru and not that one. So I'm upset because he took that one, but the same thing happened. A Subaru station was stolen. Same thing. It happened to me, mine, so I go, oh. If the other guy had had his Subaru station stolen, I wouldn't have noticed at all. Quite happily gone home in my own. Nothing to do with me. There's something wrong with this story, with all of this. I take myself so seriously, but I am not there all the time. If I go to sleep, the self goes to sleep with me. When I was a small baby, I didn't know I was me. Still don't know, actually. There's something, even though we are so in it and totally inside the experience of me, there's something that doesn't feel right with that, because it's not there all the time, totally unchanged. It changes. It moves. Before we were 6 months, we didn't have it. Then we had it. So something there tells us it's not as solid as we think. It's something perhaps that we learned, but not something that actually is totally a thing. And in the Dharma, there is a sense that we are locked in a dream. And the dream is the dream of me. And that we need to wake up from a dream in which I am the center of the universe and I am in control of life. And there is me here and the world there. And someone has made a spell to make that happen. And we need to wake up from a spell, from a dream. And that's why the most common word that is used for Nibbana is awakening. The Buddha said, I'm not a king, I'm not a prince, I'm not a god, I'm not an angel, I simply woke up. And it's this sense of waking up from a sleep, and the sleep is being locked in me. Or at least that's one of the ways we can look at the sleep. When the Buddha woke, the more or less the first teaching he gave, and he gave it to his five buddies, who were his five friends on the journey, who felt that he betrayed them in eating and in realizing softness, the middle way. But then they became his first students. And more or less the first teaching he gave was about this. Because them and others, all through the Buddhist suttas, are saying, yeah, you're teaching about anatta, selfing, no self, but whose knee is hurting when you sit? He was asked by many people, so I don't understand. My knee is hurting, it's mine. So whose knee can it be except mine? So his answer was that if you look at experience, it is made up of many things. It's made up of perception, it's made up of a physical body, it's made up of senses, it's made up of memory, of recognition. It's made up of consciousness. So one moment of experience is made up of many parts, and each part of that is passing, is moving and changing. Obviously, every second we're experiencing something new. Everything is moving and changing. The fact that everything changes causes us problems, because we don't want things to change. We want things to be the same. Life comes and does things to us. We die. We get old. We get sick. We lose things. So change causes suffering. We want everything to be absolutely fine. We want mother's milk all the time, all our life. Chalav em, non-stop. That's what we want. But everything changes. So the Buddha said, if everything changes, and that causes us, or our experience constantly changes, and that causes us suffering, how can we call that experience me and mine? How can we want such a thing that's changing all the time and making us troubles? We can't call it, it would be absurd to call it me. We wouldn't want a me like that. Who wants a me like that? Who wants a me that is causing us suffering and always changing? We don't want a me. So there's something wrong with the me model, because there's something wrong with it, because it's changing all the time and causing us problems. So what's wrong with the me model that we have? And one basic answer is that the self, the me, is not a thing, but is a response. It's the tguva. It's not something. It's just arising in response to situations. Situations create a self in us, a self response. And all beings are doing it. Every little ant and every little insect and every little amoeba has a little bit of me inside it. And humans have a big consciousness, so we have a big me. And the cat that came in has a slightly less consciousness, so a little less me. But the cat still has a me. And this is ahamkara, the tendency for I-making, me-making, which is an active process. It's not a thing called a me. It's a tendency for all living beings to make a subject in them, to create subjectivity. And maybe that word needs, in Hebrew, subjectivut, okay. The tendency, and philosophers are calling it the tendency of the universe, not just a being, because we come out of the universe. We come out of, life comes out of carbon and hydrogen and oxygen. So there is a tendency in the universe to create subjectivity, to create life and subjectivity. And that's ahamkara. And it's philosophers and scientists and psychologists are very busy with this issue. And they really agree with the Buddha here. It's that we don't agree with the Buddha and we don't agree with scientists. I often think about this because there's a lot of truth in science. I was a scientist for many years of my life. And science is pretty clear. Neurology and so on is pretty clear, in agreement with the Buddha, that selfing is a process that happens. It's a dynamic process in response to the situation. Psychologists talk about it, for example, as a social self. The relationships build an identity. Identity is not a thing, but it's a relationship too. Psychology knows this very well. Science knows that. In fact, Professor Thomas Metzinger, who I quite like as a philosopher and a scientist, and he said, if you take science seriously, you have to come to the conclusion that a self is simply the tendency for organization of a being. That the being needs to organize itself to be coordinated so it can run away from danger. But there isn't a self there. It's an organizing principle. It's a dynamic principle of self-organization. Irgun Atzmi. Thank you. Maybe we should do the other way around. Maybe you sit here. I will talk in your ear. And there's millions of bits of information going on all the time in our consciousness. And there's an organizing principle that pulls it all together in some amazing way and makes out of that a self. I have a quote from Jacob Needleman, who said, "Beneath the fragile sense of personal identity, the individual is actually an innumerable einspor, swarm, like a swarm of bees, of disconnected impulses, thoughts, reactions, opinions, and sensations, which are triggered into activity by causes of which he's entirely unaware." Exactly what the Buddha said. Self is a response and not a thing. Yet at each moment, the individual identifies himself with whichever of this swarm of impulses and reactions happens to be active, automatically affirming or saying each as me, himself. So what we do is summarize our experience, or say sikum of our experience moment by moment, calling that me. And what it needs is a huge, huge operation of filtering, of sinun, of checking what's right, what I agree with, what I want, what I need, what's relevant. And if we didn't do that, we either be a Buddha or we'd be crazy. There is an old Jewish story of a man that prayed to God and said, I want total seeing, complete sight. And God said, okay, I'll give it to you. So he gave him total seeing, and he was in absolute total bliss. He saw everything. And came lunchtime, and his wife brought the soup. And he looked at the soup, and he saw the chaydakim, the bacteria inside. He saw the way the soup was made of shit, of this, of that. He saw the earth inside. He saw the sky and the sweat of the people making the food. He saw the soup of the soup of the soup. He saw everything inside the soup and everything that belonged to the soup, and he saw the whole universe in the soup, and he couldn't eat it. So I can't eat this. Pushed it away. Supper time came. Nice meal. Meat. This. Saw the dead animals, saw the difficult, saw the pain, saw the molecules, saw the what was in the soup, saw the elements, saw the universe, saw I can't eat this. And he took it away. And he said, after two or three days of this, he was totally starving. He prayed to God, please, please take away my infinite sight. It's just a nightmare. So we need a huge operation of filtering, sinun, selection, minimize our world according to our interests, what is right, what is not dangerous, what is good for me, what I need for survival, what I have to check, what's helpful for me, and what's minimum pain and suffering. And there we go, to that, and to that one, and to that one. And we forget and we ignore the rest. In three ways, that in psychology, the self is broadly defined, as in Western psychology, is broadly defined as three movements. One is ownership. One is boundaries of space and time. Where is the limit of my body? So I need to know when I do that, I am going to get the food and not just air. Or when I walk out of the way of a car in the road, I need to know where is the car and where is me. So ownership, boundaries, and agency, meaning ani hamafaked, I am in control. I am in control of my actions. So here's breaking it down into three very broad categories. It's interesting. A couple of weeks ago, they put me in a machine in Bar-Ilan University. And they were actually looking at the self in the brain. So I was, they asked me, Aviva is a friend of mine, and an old Dharma practitioner, and she asked me to actually meditate and practice dividing the self into those three categories. So we did three experiments, one on ownership, sense of ownership, one on sense of boundary and boundarylessness, and one on sense of agency. So exactly those three, they must be very well built inside the Western view of self. You probably know more about it than I do. So the problem with the self is that it wants to be immortal. Al-Mavit. It doesn't want change. It is something that wants to keep things just the same. Life comes along and does all our best plans. Life just comes. Life doesn't pay attention to our interests. Life is full of change. Life changes us. We don't want it. So there is a mismatch, a not fitting situation of a self that wants to protect itself and build a shirion, an armor around itself, and keep things right inside. Enough food, enough sugar in the blood, enough love, enough money in the bank, enough, just keep it, just perfect conditions. And life is constantly coming and going. Yeah, you thought you got it right. Boom. Yeah, okay. I'm not paying attention to you, your needs. Forget it. Take a virus. Take a loss. Get your car stolen. Life comes and does everything. And the self is trying to hold on. And we spend our entire life busy with it. And that's, in a way, the tragedy of being inside the self. That our entire life is spent maintaining this self, holding on to it, getting it right, protecting it from even, there was a study done in American University about what people are most afraid of. And I heard this from Christopher one time, that at the head of the list was public speaking. Somewhere down on the list was total nuclear warfare that destroyed the human race. So Christopher's comment was, people are more afraid of the ego dying than their body dying. The ego death is much more frightening. We work our whole life. We are busy our whole life with the fear of death. We are like a moth around a fire, constantly in some way busy with the fear of death, trying to sort life out so that we are protected. We're busy our whole life with ambition, with hard work, with collecting things, with filling the fridge with food, with protecting ourselves, with building armies and nuclear weapons to make sure that we will be okay. We're constantly, our whole life, we devote to this. And it's total devotion to the self. It's devotion. So, we can begin to look a little bit more carefully at this self. And we find something really interesting. That the only reason we can say we have a self is because we don't see it. Because we look through it at the world. If we saw the way we build a self from moment to moment, doing it just like Jacob Needleman says, collecting impressions, and building a self out of them, if we saw it, we wouldn't take the self so seriously. Because we don't see it, it's become automatic. And that's why we feel totally identified with things. We're unquestioning a me in the middle. Never mind what the Buddha said, never mind what scientists say, never mind the fact that we never had it until the age of 9 months, never mind anything. We absolutely believe there is a self because we look through it at the world. It's transparent. We don't know the process of ahamkara, building it up. We don't see it. We look through it. So it's, we don't see the ego, we see the world with the ego. We use the ego to see the world. We don't see the ego of a self. So we're built, the self is built on all these things, belief, assumptions, hanachot, interpretations, memories, etc. It's built all the time. And we build a model of me and the world, which is built from the very small baby. The separation, the baby separates itself from the world, but the baby is the world, of course, but has made an act or a separation in order to survive of protection. I am here and the world is there. And built a model of the world. And it, spiritually, we can't afford to keep that illusion. As the Buddha said, we have to wake up out of it. Because it closes us off. Spirituality, if we're interested in spirituality, we have to look at this process and not be locked inside the self. There's a quote from William Blake that you very much, I'm sure all of you know it, or many of you know it. It's the title of a book by Aldous Huxley, who is a spiritual teacher, or at least a wise sage, a wise man from way back, my childhood, but still a great thinker. And William Blake said, if the doors of perception are cleansed, means the doors, means the senses, chushim, doors of perception, everything will appear as it is, infinite. For man has closed himself up till he sees all things through narrow gaps in the cave. Small gaps. So, what is anatta then? What is so-called non-self? Well, basically, non-self is not non. It's not nothing. It's not emptiness. Anatta is not non-self. It is that there's no permanent entity that we can call self. We can't find any permanent thing that we call self. Because the thing is dynamic. We are creating it at the moment of perception. So there isn't an entity inside us, even if we believe that there is, which we can identify as me. So we can look at the self, anatta, as ki'ilu, non-self, translated into English as non-self from the Pali, as more the unfindability of the self. We actually can experience life without it. It's perfectly possible. to have experiences with no self, no selfing there at all. A baby does it, we can do it too. And those experiences tend to be more unbounded, infinite, beyond. They tend to be about interconnection with the world, not seeing through the me, but letting go into the world. Experience doesn't have to have it. So when we begin to look in our meditation practice, in our spiritual practice, and like I say, it doesn't have to be Buddhist, when we begin to look at this, when the self is less automatic, we begin to see the way that we make the self. We form it out of conditions and conditioning, hatnaya. We see that it's a message that is built into the system through conditioning. We learnt it. We learnt to respond to the world through the self-image, the self-model. We see the way it's expressed. We see, just like we were doing today, response to something, there the self arises. Something happens, we respond, there is a self. It's obvious that if someone takes our meditation cushion and it will come into the room and there isn't one, pitom, self jumps up big time. Ah, what's happened? Someone took my cushion. Big time. When we're relaxed on the floor, totally relaxed, totally at ease, there's not much self there, a bit. Yeah, I'm here, it's a me, sense of center. But the self is not very strong. So the self, anyway, if we look carefully, is going to be there and less and more and less and more. So it's not a thing if it's less and more and less and more. And a lot of, we don't need, just to kind of relax you a little bit around this thing of non-self anatta, we don't need to discover that there is something that we experience called selfing that isn't there. We don't need to ki'ilu wipe it out, to take some drug, hardama klali, just wipe out the self, because the Buddha said anatta, no self. We need to be less interested in selfing. It's another way of doing things. It's another attitude. Less interested in whether the self is there or not there, or how it's there or if it's there. Just to drop the interest. And that, with that dropping of interest, we drop a huge amount of suffering. Imagine, just a small example, how much we're busy with what people think of us. Tadmi, that's me. Or tadmi? How much we're busy with that. If we were less caring about self appearing, not appearing, how much, more, less, that drops straight away. That's one of the first, it will just drop. It will just be completely uninteresting what people think of you. And that's not so difficult. It's not that we have to wipe out the self in order to develop spiritually, but we have to take the self less seriously. Be less locked in it at all times. It's hard to work that one out, though. It's hard to understand that. We can't look at this logically. We can't, the mind finds it hard to see this. One of the best responses, and some of you have already said this in the groups, I'm very confused about the self. That's the best place to be. It is absolutely fine. Very confused about the self is right on. You're right on the path. Okay? Because from there, very confused about the next one is, actually, I don't really need it so much, this self. It's not about getting rid of anything. It's about taking the self more lightly, taking ourselves more lightly, letting things go, letting identification be less intensive. Experiences happen and they pass by. We don't need to invest so much energy in identification, izdahut. We can have a thought passing by, just knowing it, but not identifying with it. Lezahot, v'lo lehizdahot. And there's a relief in that. Okay, it's just a thought. Judgment, she put you, judgment. Yes, it's just a thought. The identification gives it the pain. But just a thought, it's not painful. It's just a thought. Comes from conditions and goes away again. So taking things more lightly is kind of really possible for us. And really something that we can do in this retreat. And reducing the intensity of the point of view of me. And when we do that, another point of view arises in us. And that's the point of view of life. And we begin to look at things with a life point of view and not a me point of view. That life in us is looking. And in a little bit, we don't call it that language, but we do it. When we're in bodily life, our body is talking. Like I was in the instructions on the walking meditation the other day, I was saying, you know, how do the feet look at the world? What are the feet? Feet are part of the world. How do they look at things? How does life look at things? How do the trees look at things? How does everything look? What is the point of view of something bigger than me? So we relax around the me point of view, and by itself comes a life point of view, bit by bit by bit. And I finish with a quote from Chesterton, who said, "Why do angels fly? Because they take themselves so lightly." This is one of my favorite quotes. So we can be angels that fly. Just take ourselves more lightly. Thank you.